Hi, this is the Dark Tangent. The speech you're about to listen to is recorded at DEF CON 4 at the Monte Carlo Casino and Resort, freshly built in 1996. Copyright, all right reserves, except permission is expressly granted for non-profit educational use. Now sit back and relax. If you have any questions, please contact me at dtangent@defcon.org or visit our website, www.defcon.org. Thank you, and kick back and relax. Let's give everybody a welcome for Rich Thiem.
Thanks, DT. Omnipotent. I've got a lot of introductions. I've never had omnipotent yet. That's cool. I'll keep that. What I've got is about half an hour to want to share with you some of the fruits of 52 years of life on Earth and interacting with and reflecting on some of the stuff that has brought many of you here today and how it relates to the bigger picture. It's the bigger picture I'm interested in. What is going on the planet? And how what you do, those of you who are best at it, who do it best, how that it really is the vanguard of a way of thinking and a way of being and a way of acting in the world, which is going to be the most valuable thing in the next century. So I'm going to put out a few modules. You can plug them into each other in any way you want, and it will run in any direction. But what it's really about is power, having it, using it, knowing you have it, knowing you're having an impact, and what is the best way to exercise power and identity as individuals and as a culture. And I'm going to be grandiose and talk about identity as a species, which I believe is changing. And it's about paradox, because a lot of the people who come here, including myself, often function best alone, and yet the only reason to be here is to connect with one another in some kind of community, however transitory and modular it is, and find out how to give and receive information in ways that work and don't violate our trust and the bonds we form with each other. So what I'm going to try to build in half an hour, roughly, is a structure of possibility about what it really is going to mean to be fully human going into the next century, even as we're going through a transformation, which I think is as deep as anything that we have ever experienced as a species. Because our interaction with the distributed computer network on the globe is a symbiotic relationship in which we change it and it changes us, and each one of us responds in a dialectic that does take us all up a rising spiral of mutual transformation. We are not the same as we were 10 years ago. You know, so I'm lucky, I think, in that I'm 52 years old and I was immersed in text as I grew up. I wrote fiction. I taught literature at the University of Illinois. I was steeped in the world that text gave me as a way to frame reality. And as I am struggling to continue to walk the bridge to a way of being a person engaged with electronic networks, I find that the contrast between who I am and who I was really is profound. Because each transformation in what I call the technology of the word, capital W, changes what it means to be human. You know, some of it is going to sound trite. McLuhan said all this a generation ago, and none of us knew how to listen to what he was saying. But when people first began to speak, millions of years ago, it's likely that the first thing they did is get really pissed off and start complaining about what they had lost. Because now you could speak about anything and kill time speaking, and it was wasted. And they had lost the unconscious communion of the tribe, which they had had for millions of years through telepathy and clairvoyance. And the objections people probably raised against the technology of speech were identical to what drove Plato crazy when writing appeared. He thought writing was the end of civilization. And the things he said writing was going to do to human culture, which it did, are the same things that people said were going to happen after the printing press was invented and after computers began to be connected to one another. So what Plato said is that civilization is over. And in a way he was right. Civilization as it existed is over. And what is being born is the process of transformation. Now, there are buzzwords we hear all the time, like paradigm change, transformation. They've become so current, they've lost their potency. But my experience of going through true transformation as an individual is that what it means is we go through a zone of annihilation a real zone of annihilation in which everything we have thought ourselves to be is truly called into question and held up for us as no longer true about ourselves. And before we restructure our psyches around a new center, it feels like going crazy. And I think this is why, when I talk to people, older people in businesses, in government, and school districts especially, about what we're going through, what I see in their glazed eyes is fear and anger. Scott McNeely says the only thing he sees motivating people these days is anger and fear. And so I just hold out to you as an exercise in compassion that those who do not have your skills in knowing how to engage with the world that's being born are experiencing this zone of annihilation in which what they thought it meant to be human and function on the planet is being eradicated. It's like before the French Revolution, you know, a couple hundred years ago, if you told people in France that everything was going to go down all at once, the monarchy and the aristocracy and the church and the military, you would have been shot or guillotined or laughed at. But 5 years later, everything fell at once, like when the Berlin Wall fell and the first domino pushed. And so when there's a hierarchical restructuring of the way we structure our lives, it feels like everything is falling apart until things coalesce in a new way that includes and transcends everything that came before. So the generation gap I encounter is more profound than what I lived through in the 60s as a younger person. The day before I came here, I was talking to the aide of a senator in Washington, and he said, I can't tell you who it was, but I got to tell you this story so you understand the mindset of roughly two-thirds of the senators who are passing the bills that affect the kind of stuff you're concerned with. It was the first subcommittee set up as an interactive hearing using power books and chat, and the senator presided over it, an older guy, lots of seniority, walked in, and the aide said to him, okay, senator, begin your chat. And he looked at the power book and he said, hello? Hello? It's not talking to me. Hello? And he held that out as an example, he thought, of the two-thirds of the people in the Senate he knows that do not do email and do not know how to use a keyboard, and how quickly the audience divides into those who immediately compute whether they can die or retire before they have to deal with this stuff, and therefore feel helpless and frightened and powerless. Now, part of what hacking is about is power. It is a power rush. Every time some key clicks in a lock and the lock opens and the puzzle is solved and you go to a new level, there's a power rush which often comes from inducing fear. And I learned that if you induce fear in the person perceived to be an opponent, their behavior becomes rigid and predictable. And the word hacker and the image hacker induces in a large part of the population fear. You know, but I want to set forth a possible paradox for you to at least consider when you go out of here, which is the very need for power itself comes from fear, and the need to be powerful electronically comes from our fear. I mean, I'm a speaker. I've been speaking since I was in my 20s in one way or another in different kinds of work, and I know I went into it because when I was 13 and got up to give a speech I had to give in school, I started blushing, became profoundly self-conscious, became terrified, sat down, everybody laughed, I was embarrassed. There's a part of me every single time I get up that has to push through that membrane of fear in order to walk through until the words start to come. So in a world in which information really is currency and knowledge is capital, your power to float in and out at the speed of light of the channels and data banks of information is the most powerful level you can have on the rock of reality. So I'm going to talk a little bit, too, about how dangerous it is to think you do that unobserved. The freedom we perceive out there in cyberspace is allowed, not seized. And that's important to remember. So I know they say things about us, about how isolated, what loners we are, the fearful images of the person hunched in the darkness over a glowing screen, invading boardrooms and bedrooms. And I remember when I was a kid, they said the same thing about reading. And I remember my friend Tubby, who never came out of his basement and did nothing but connect to the world through electronics, through radios. I won't tell you who he is now, but they call him Mr. Tubby. Yeah? And he's got a powerful position. You know, Clark said that any technology sufficiently advanced to be incomprehensible is perceived as magic. Well, what you do is experienced by most of the population around you as magic. And therefore, you are experienced as sorcerers. And this is why it is frightening. It is fear that we have to dominate. And I know where the power comes from. You know, Odin, the myth of Odin, he hung for 9 days and nights, suffering and alone in a tree, in order to grab the magic of the runes. And that powerful myth is a myth that I think connects to us and why we will do anything to know, to go where we need to go, to get what we need to get, in order to do what you know you need to do. And because this transformation is as profound as I suggest, I just want to hold out the possibility that it's not a new species that's being born, but it's a new variation of a species. I call it Homo sapiens hacki. And it is a genuinely new variation because you perceive and structure and frame reality in a different way. And if that's the way you have always done it, I just want to hold out that you can't know how profoundly different it is because there is nothing with which to contrast it. I mean, example, education. You know, adolescence was invented by the printing press. Think about it. Before the printing press, people learned by apprenticeship. That is, they learned by doing alongside the adults who taught them in proximity what it was they had to know. They were 10, 11, 12. That's why hormones kick in then. And when the printing press was invented, it changed the definition of education to mean the manipulation of typographic symbols on pages, in books, and you sit at a bench like this and read books. Adolescence was invented as a name for the structure of time during which adulthood now had to be postponed a decade, while the hormones continued to go crazy, while people learned how to deal with the internalization of those typographic symbols. Is it any wonder that the smartest people electronically can't sit still in school? Because the very structures of education themselves are being completely undermined and sabotaged. When I talk to teachers, it's the brightest of them who, when they start to catch on, say, then we got to get computers into the schools. We got to get them here. And then there's a moment when they perceive that computers aren't as cheap and portable as books, and there is no need to get them there. And just as printing press invented benches and books, the computer is de-inventing school systems as they have existed for a couple of hundred years. And that's why so much more education takes place in rooms like these. Businesses holding seminars, doing re-education, setting up their own universities, are coping with the fact that the school system is coming apart because it's designed as a hierarchical structure that delivers information at the pleasure of the hierarchy and the command and control teacher, when what is needed is more of a coach, someone who knows what it is you're doing, so they can allow you to find out what you need to find out and be available to help when needed. And the computer delivers the information when we need it, when we make mistakes, when we're teachable. You know, the best I know is a fourth grade teacher who was supposed to teach computers to kids, and she didn't know how to turn one on. So what she did is ask for her three brightest kids to meet with her after school secretly and teach her how to use the computer so she could teach the rest of the class how to use the computer. That is at most a tentative holding action. No, that's only going to stave off reality for so long. So this is one of the ways it changes us. And it's also changing the future. You know about future scenarios. Peter Schwartz and the Global Business Network came up with multiple scenarios for imagining the future because exponential change, that is things changing so fast we can't keep up with it, means that you have to predicate possible futures and then consistently get feedback and data to evaluate which ones are evolving so you can cross-correlate that with your experience and readjust your view of the future. That way of structuring the future didn't exist before computerization. People thought of the future incrementally as a straight line, kind of connect the dots. When you went into a business 30 years ago, you learned about management by objectives as if you could control where you were going to go, instead of as today, when you have to ally yourself with every enemy and possible partner because no one has a clue as to what is coming next, and you just have to be partnered in a way that enables you to be ready for whatever it is that emerges on the horizons. The future as a possibility for action, a way to structure your way of being in the world. What I'm trying to suggest has changed fundamentally, and therefore how you hold yourself in the world as a possibility for action has changed. The other thing it does when you interact with a web or a network instead of a hierarchy is you internalize the structure of the system of information with which you interact in a way that redefines your psyche. Let me give you an example. I was doing a corporate retreat for a bank. They were about to engage in reorganization. Nobody was more frightened than these guys, looking at the way banking was changing and knowing they didn't know what to do to move into the world of electronic banking. And I talked to a lot of them one-on-one before the retreat, and each one of them talked about banking, the bank. The bank itself as the obstacle. These were people who were smart, had great resources, but they all talked about the bank as the problem over which they could not get. And when I had them in one room at one time, I could ask them the question, where's the bank? And the only answer they could see, because there was no structure around them of a building or tellers, is that the bank in their heads. It was the bank in their heads, the way they constructed reality, that was the obstacle to their acting. And when you function in a network or web, you learn to exercise power in a different way. You cannot exercise it in a direct command and control way. In a network, you learn to work by participating and contributing. The best of a hacker ethic holds forth a possibility of community in which information is free and shared so that you can then use power in a responsible way. And it is key to use it in a responsible way. Dead Addict was saying last night, of course I wrote it down, that's where I get all my lines. I was talking about the one time I had my scanner on and I was listening to must have been a cordless call, because cellular is not legal where I live. So it must have been a cordless call that I was overhearing. And it was one of those few wonderful serendipity times where you know all the parties and it's a power broker situation and you know something that they don't know, and it's 20 to midnight and the union negotiations end at midnight and you could make the phone call that could make the difference. And instead of making the phone call to the person downtown who was waiting for the union's response, I called the person who made the call and said, you know, you shouldn't broadcast these deliberations on an FM radio. And so the power rush came, instead of helping my friend, from the way they gasped and the silence on the phone. That is the pleasure. You get it one way or the other. But what Dead Addict said is, that's the trouble with being God. You can look, but you can't touch. Profound, profound insight. Once you start touching, you start screwing it up. Okay. One of the other things that is happening inevitably, and it's why you're hearing so much, you hear from Winkler in a minute and Bruce yesterday, security in the global workplace. Every business, in fact, I think every individual, now must function as if they are a country, an independent country. And that means they must engage intentionally and powerfully in both managing information and intelligence and counterintelligence and disinformation. In other words, it's no longer an option or a luxury for a company to act as if they don't have to worry about who knows what about them and what they can learn about somebody else. And that is why the mediating structures are where the power is going to be located. The filters for information, whether smart agents or human beings, who know how to get the information and above all connect it in meaningful ways. Competitive business intelligence is now going to be a 101 course in any business school that's worth its salt. You know, the only difference I know between a virus and an antibiotic is which side is it on and which side are you on. It's the same structure of information gathering. Now, disinformation is an art. An article I wrote for a magazine in England got the attention of an advertising firm there, and they emailed me and said, would you like to go on the net and do brand defense with us? And I said innocently, what is brand defense? They said, well, it means when one of our clients is attacked, what we do then is go on the internet in a variety of personas, guises, aliases. Some go into Usenet groups, some set up web pages, some simply engage in flame wars, banter, anything we can do to distract the attention of the populace from our poor besieged client so that they can trot off unnoticed and let the war continue, the war of words, the war of symbols, the war of abstractions, gathering everybody's energy into a distraction. disinformation as an art, because the level of abstraction presented to us by the internet is the highest with which we have ever engaged. Without going into it in detail, what you get on the net is symbols of symbols of symbols of symbols, and no structure of accountability, i.e. footnotes, references, and a place to cross-correlate the data in order to infer in a reasonable way what is true about what you're looking
at. So somebody must have added on.
Okay, so Plato was right. Copies of copies with no originals is what we often stumble into, and because the net is such a powerfully projective medium, we provide credibility for the images of images and images of text at which we are looking as if it has its own integrity and structure, when in fact it may simply be a very artful construct. You know what I mean? I've never been at a convention in which paranoia and fear was so threaded through so many conversations, because we all know we're walking in a hall of mirrors in which the aliases we have used, the personas we have created, the images we put out there may be known, may be not known. We may be talking to someone who works for somebody else who doesn't really know who they work for. I mean, you know. And once you start getting lost in that hall of mirrors, your ability to just show up as a human being and exchange data in a trusted way is undermined, the way we like to dream anyway. It used to take place in the confabs once upon a time.
Okay.
Just very briefly, one of the things that is being transformed electronically is the very structure of religious institutions and what it means to be in a quest for meaning. And I won't dwell on this, but just as the printing press ended the domination of the Roman Catholic Church forever by disseminating the possibility of a variety of denominations which have been at war with each other in words ever since, the structure of religious institutions as we have known them is over. Now, you can walk dead for a long time before you fall over. So you can go on with momentum and inertia for a long time. But the religious institutions were created first by writing, because every major religious figure in the world, Buddha, Confucius, Jesus, Moses, occurred in a very narrow band of timeline in history, which is vast, and it happened to coincide with when writing created of those historical figures, textual beings. And every religious person interacts not with the being, but with the text, which discloses a horizon of possibility to them. And when you interact with images and beings who are disclosed to you electronically, it creates a different kind of horizon and a different possibility for what it means to be human. I just have a hunch that it is in the moos and the muds, which are kind of the brackish, swampy tidewaters of the internet, that images and aliases and avatars will emerge on the edge of life where it happens in the swamp, that are going to define the possibility for future electronic religious communities that are going to deliver real goods to people who connect in community online. It's going to look like Marianne Moore said of poetry. She said it's imaginary gardens with real toads in them. And that's what it is when we go online. Level of abstraction higher than ever, but what we connect with is each other and reality. And last but not least, don't limit yourself to a 20th century view of what it is that is happening. I titled this talk originally, Hacking is Practice for Transplanetary Life in the 21st Century.
Okay, so
I want to say what I mean by that.
Like
we live now primarily on Earth, but we have been throughout the solar system. And in your lifetime, probably, we're going to colonize other worlds and live in space stations. The stuff that for me as a kid was the stuff of science fiction, which I started to write as a way to imagine the future. We're going to go to other worlds. And when I look at the images of Hubble on the net, it reminds me that Columbus was a map maker before he was an explorer. And so he had to draw and internalize the structure of the world he drew sufficiently to then get up and go. And when I look at those pictures of Hubble exploding galaxies and extraordinary lenses of gravitational contraction at unimaginable distances, it makes me want to go. We are now looking at the maps that are going to define for us the horizon. And it is relevant to what I'm talking about, because the skills needed in transplanetary culture are the skills of hackers. One, you have to live easily in the non-space of the mutual hive mind that we call cyberspace. I know a lot of people hate the word cyberspace, but I don't know a better one. And if you know a better one, please tell me after the talk, and I'll use it. But I'm still grateful to Gibson for what I think was just a tremendous imagining and visioning, and it's a good word. And it means the non-space of the mind in which you know how it is that we connect out there, almost bodiless, where time and space are constructed differently. When we're planetary or even transgalactic, we're going to have to be comfortable living with the contraction or disappearance of time and space and move through wormholes that distort and otherwise twist, like LSD. That's a drug that used to be used in the 60s, for those of you who are looking. Like, sometimes redefines the geodesic lines of our minds. Comment? I won't even touch that. I haven't seen any evidence of drug use here other than a few people smoking cigarettes and occasional beer. And I've been moved and touched by your restraint. And two, you have to learn to be at ease with modular life. What do I mean by that? I mean, I know a lot of people back in the Midwest who thought you graduated from school, went to work, died from work, and went to the grave, and that was it. Modular life means, as you know, things come together and come apart like a time-lapse photography. The flower opens and it closes like that. Online, communities form, coalesce, form structure, like shuttles docking at a space station. Life is modular in a developmental timeline sense. In that, like me, I'm in my third major career, and I've never been more happy in my life doing what I'm doing, because I needed to break out of a structure that was suffocating and constraining and did not allow me to think in the way I can now think. You will move through different identities and online with avatars, aliases, and possibilities as a way to try out what those are, as long as you stay connected to the core self that you know yourself to be, and don't mistake that core self for one of the aliases you use. Know who you are separate from that. But it means people who live on the boundaries of things are going to thrive. Suddenly, businesses are interested in me for the first time in my life. Why? Because those are people who have always lived at the center. And I've always lived on the edge in what I thought was a creative way and what others thought was a neurotic and insane way. I thought it worked pretty well because I could see from the outside how everybody else structured their life. And suddenly they hire me because the center of life is shifting so rapidly and repeatedly that people who want to be at the center find the center puts them at the edge. And they need pathfinders who know how to live on the edge to show them how to live in things that move so fast you can't photograph them or make them stop or be tame. You know how to do that. Another thing, you have a desire. I know this, I know it for a fact. You have a desire and a passion and a craving to know. If anything, you are need-to-know machines. If you've been hardwired, it's machines that must know what things do, how they work, where is the information stored, how can I get it, how can I connect it, how can I put it together. I, too, have lived my life in various personas that enabled me to go to the depths of the lives of the people I worked with or served in order to find out what it meant to be a fully human being. You know intuitively that information does want to be free and linked and accessible, because that magnifies power and spreads it throughout the complete hive. And you have a love of adventure. You are willing to take risks. You know the wonderful warmth of the flame on the edge of your wings. You love to live on the edge, put things together, figure it out, and make a difference. And somehow leave electronic marks that say, I was here, kind of like electronic territory staked out by a virtual Tomcat. This is my territory. I go anywhere. I go where I want to go. That is deep archetypal stuff. And that's why you see firewalls as wonderful challenges and not something to pass by on the way somewhere else. You live on the edge of chaos. You remember those great experiments with artificial life? It showed as fast as you could move the algorithms that simulated DNA, there was a nice little structure they built. When it was moving so slow, when information travels in a system so slowly, it becomes like molasses, moribund. There's no life. When it moves so fast that the algorithms can't connect with one another and replicate, then it's chaotic, and there's no life there either. But there's a band where life is optimized between rigidity and chaos. And life, it turns out, is optimized living right on the edge of chaos, always feeling like you're going to fall off the edge, but never quite falling. And that is a skill that is going to be needed in a world where change continues to happen exponentially. Who do you trust in this world? You want to connect with people and learn from them, but we live in a panopticon. You know that word? Synopticon, Jeremy Bentham's prison, 19th century jail reformer. It's a circle, like a pie. The tower is in the center. The cells are wedge-shaped pie shapes. And it means the person in the tower can see the people in the cells all the time. But they can't see him or her. They can't see each other. And because of what's happening with global positioning satellites and the dissemination of cross-correlated databases, you know, everybody can know anything they want to know about anybody realistically. And what is it going to do to life to live as if we're in a virtual jail, always locatable on the face of the earth, always known, always observable? You know that that feeling of power comes in part from anonymity, and yet you also know that every click of your click stream is a luminous footprint out there that anybody who wants to track can track. Every telephone, as you know, is tappable or scannable. And every word you speak, including this and what you whisper to one another while I'm speaking, is overhearable. Because you know what the technology enables us to do, because you use it. Who can you trust in this hall of mirrors? Do any of us really think we're smart enough to outsmart the rest of everybody else? Remember the line in Body Heat when Teddy trying to tell the lawyer, he says, "Remember what you told me, counselor? There are 100 ways you can screw up. And if you think of 50 of them, you're a genius. And counselor, you ain't no genius." It is good counsel to remember. A friend of mine is connected to about, I don't know how many, 17,000 databases in over 120 countries. She does competitive business intelligence. She finds people. She finds money. She finds things. She says she has never found somebody who can disappear. You're going to hear from Newman, who's terrific, I think, is here, and does a lot with changing identities, and it's great stuff. But she's tracked people through three identities and traced them down to the single revealing pattern of behavior they couldn't eradicate from their soul or hide. And in one case, she served a subpoena on somebody whose weakness was brunettes, which is what she was. And when in the bar in Seattle, he leaned forward thinking he was making a score, she put the subpoena in his pocket. Bingo. End of case. You cannot hide what it is you crave or love, no matter whether you change your identity, your eye color, your hair. Much of what feels like freedom out there is allowed by those who will steal your golden nuggets if they can. And the danger of playing in the world is that we don't even always know what the gold is. So how close can you fly to the flame without being burned? You have got to mentor one another. You have got, as the hacker community matures, to learn how to grow and transform yourselves with it in order to continue to provide the dissemination of the essential information, not only about how to hack, but how to survive hacking and live to play a game another day. As the community matures, and those of you who started out years ago graduate, if you don't find a way to mentor the little ones who are coming up, you're going to stop learning and growing, because that's what it means to graduate, is learn how to share what you know how to do in a meaningful way while also protecting yourself from the inordinate demands of those who are too lazy to do their homework. But you've got to find the ones who know what they need to do in order to bring to you the critical questions. So the bottom line is, God, know yourself. Know who you are. Use your work. Use your network. Use your projections in order to know yourself. Guy mentioned to me Darth Vader time. You remember when Luke Skywalker took off Darth Vader's helmet and what he saw was his own face? That has been my experience. Everything I have chased or hated, I have finally had to confront in my life was deeply true about myself. The dark side of the Force is everywhere, and it is so mixed up and ambiguous and complex that we can't separate one from the other. There's so much concern about undercover work here. Every undercover agent I've known, and I've known like three very well as friends, has said to me that the line in the movie was correct. I don't know if I'm a cop pretending to be a criminal or a criminal pretending to be a cop. People go into the work that enables them to do what they love to do as freely as they can. Who is the enemy? Ask yourself, who is the enemy, and to whom can you be loyal? It is not your behaviors, I just want to say, that are a threat. It is not what people tell you that is true is a threat. Not your behaviors, because those behaviors are done by the establishment all the time. It is your perceived allegiance and your perceived threat It is the kind of community you create that frightens and threatens people that is the threat itself, not what it is you do. So the task is to find a way to do what you want to do that is free and powerful and enables you to get up the next morning and come back to the game. I just want to conclude by saying this is one of the greatest places I've ever been. A friend asked me what it was like here. I said I felt like I was finally home. Most of the people are brilliant and most are hopelessly neurotic. My brothers and my sisters at last. It's a terrific group. And what you know how to do is what you're going to need to know how to do, and other people will pay you a lot of money to show them how to do or share the fruits of your labor. But please don't die out there. It is not romantic to crash and burn. It is not worth it. Find a way to learn what you need to do as human beings, to build what you need to build, to keep playing this incredible game that it's been your gift and privilege to have. Okay, thank you very much. Q&A? Any questions? Questions? Yes. I'm shocked. I'm absolutely shocked. I had no idea. Thank you. I thought that was a long gone thing of the past. I thought weak beer was as heavy as it got. Thank you. I'm just undone. Yeah. Politicians and breeders. Yeah, especially if they... No, I won't say it. Turn your back. Yeah, there's hope, but the hope is not for that vision that the earth is going to... that the human species is going to change into everybody has enough internal security or knows how to link and network with one another to provide the mutuality they need in order to get the feedback they need to keep growing together. My experience is that in every domain of life, there is rigidity, fear, and isolation at this end of the spectrum, and there is people who are capable of taking risks, having mutuality, getting feedback, growing at this end. And I just have a hunch now that I'm 52 that over the generations, the percentages don't change all that much. And so you've got to find the people who hang out with the people who encourage you to keep growing. And the people who need that much external structure to prop them up, like Carolyn Minnell was saying yesterday. I'm sad to say, people who are stuck in rigidity seem to stay stuck in rigidity. But Abraham Lincoln said it's much easier to go around a stump than try to plow through it. You know, so let them be rigid. Go somewhere else. Yeah. Marianne Moore was her name. Poet. Mid-20th century. Anybody else? Yeah. Good question. It's too good a question to think I know the answer easily or off the top of my head. It's a great question. It's possible that you will develop alternative modalities of exercising power. And if that is true, then as you know, just as it has happened everywhere else in the world, the structures of the nation states that evolved in the 19th century for certain political and economic and technological realities will no longer hold and things will implode. In a way, you know, that's happening already. We hope it's devolution so that there's not fire in the streets, but that it will be different here than the Balkans, than Russia, than everywhere. It's a good question. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's a terrific question. To be true to my experience, I mean, I think it was Aristotle who said the golden mean is that which you notice as you pass it moving in the opposite direction. And there is that truing mechanism which you know when you see it because it resonates with you and you say, this is me, this is integrity, this is what I must do. It transcends rules, it transcends anything anybody else from outside yourself can tell you. But you kind of tack back and forth toward it through your whole life. And my experience is that, you know, Walt Whitman said, there's about as much good and evil today as there was last year and there will be next year. Everybody's very gray, very complex, and that struggle continues, but you become more at peace with it. Yeah, the truing mechanism is there. And there's certain things you can remember to be more likely to find it rather than less likely. But nobody, like, lives there. That I've met. Yeah. Okay? Okay, thanks. Oh, wait, one more. Yeah. I think he's asking, are things going to evolve or is there going to be a revolution? And I'll write that answer on a postcard and mail it to you. You know, I don't know. I don't know. You know, we hope for evolution. But we do know that the sources of the nation states that evolved in the 19th and 20th century, the boundaries around them and why they were needed no longer hold because technology has undermined the technological, the economic, the political structures by providing different ways of linking to each other globally and locally. And if we can adapt to that without dying, or I don't know. Well, it always feels like I said. The zone of annihilation is passing through the end of the way we constructed things. And they do coalesce always in a different way. They reorganize, hopefully at a higher hierarchical level that includes and transcends everything that came before. But when you're going through it, it feels like death. It feels like the death of the self or the death of the culture. But it never is. Yeah. Willingly. That's right. And people will probably die or be incarcerated as a result of that misperception. And in the 60s, the things that were perceived as radical are now institutionalized as planks in the Republican Party. But it took blood to move them forward a generation. Yes. Yeah, people are not just paranoid. Yeah. Absolutely. Yes, I think so. I think it's that fundamental. And it goes even deeper than that. The self that takes a look at itself and examines itself is being fundamentally altered by the electronic revolution. Quick example, the Catholics have a thing called self-examination prior to confession where you look at yourself. That didn't exist before the printing press because the complex, subtly nuanced self that it was examined didn't exist until the language was fixed and became a million words or more instead of the 25 or 30,000 that are true in oral cultures. So it's so fundamental that the way we are, who we experience ourselves to be, is being transformed right now. Okay? So, one more?
Right. But what I'm saying is, where is the crossover? So, okay, let me get this. Like, let's say you have tweeters in the front, what else? You have midwives. So, you have a tweeter in the midwife. see there's a passive crossover to that sequence. That's just you changing. With I think he's got an active crossover for the sub. Because that's a good crossover.
Yeah, and it's the danger of what's coming. That when you misperceive the threat, your fear projects onto it and judges people in a wholesale way. And that's why I say it's not the behavior. People who make bombs are not a problem for our government or any government. It's who's making the bomb and what is the perceived intention of the bomb. It's not weapon making, as you probably know. Yes.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely not. You're absolutely right. I will certainly not be taped saying that revolution is an integral part of evolution. What I will say is that historically it certainly has seemed that way, has it not? Okay? Okay. Thank you very much.